WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Velvet Goldmine is about the glam rock era of the early 70s, when it became fashionable for male rock stars to create androgynous alter egos and dress theatrically in wild colors, feathers, and glitter. The characters in the film are inspired by such performers as David Bowie, Brian Ferry, Iggy Pop, and Lou Reed. My guest is the screenwriter and director Todd Haynes, whose previous films include Poison and Safe. The story of Velvet Goldmine is about a glam rock star named Brian Slade who fakes his own murder, then disappears. On the 10th anniversary of his disappearance, a reporter who used to be a big fan investigates the disappearance by interviewing people who used to work with Slade. Here's the reporter, played by Christian Bale, interviewing glam rock star Kurt Wilde, played by Ewan McGregor.
I was trying to contact you, actually, about a story I was doing about an old friend of yours, Brian Slade. Trying to find out what actually happened to him.
Look.
I mean, before he became such a mystery.
Look, man, I don't know who you've been talking to or what you're after here, but...
What? What?
Listen, a real artist creates beautiful things and puts nothing of his own life into them, okay?
Is that what you did?
No. We set out to change the world. Ended up just changing ourselves.
I asked screenwriter and director Todd Haynes why he's interested in glam rock.
It's a pretty unique, as far as I see it, chapter in rock and roll history for a lot of reasons, I guess. It was this extremely flamboyant period where theatricality and costume and makeup and was being foregrounded, unlike anything that had preceded it. But it also very much woven into that were a whole series of ideas about gender and sexuality, and sort of a refusal for the artist to stand up there and speak from the gut to its his or her audience. It was more about dressing up into a variety of personas and constructing these ornate little narratives that, like Ziggy Stardust being probably the best known of those, through which to communicate these various ideas.
There's a scene in your movie, Velvet Goldmine, in which one of the characters is describing bisexuality and homosexuality as if they were styles or attitudes. You know, it's like just another costume to put on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that was the very much in opposition to 60s culture, which wore its political rhetoric very much, you know, on its sleeve. The glam ideas were given a much more fanciful, you know, lighter kind of approach. And yet I find them still to be extremely political, maybe inadvertently so, you know. And this kind of idea of sexuality as something that you could change, like your costume or your cosmetic style that for that day, is actually something I find pretty progressive in that it goes against, as all the glam sort of imagery does, goes against these very these natural models for identity and for sexuality, and instead suggests that, you know, it's for the it's sort of in the hands of the young person to decide who they are, to dress up and to try this and to try that. And I find that to be a pretty unique, another thing that sort of distinguishes it from other bits of rock and roll, which is so much about, usually about, like, authenticity and the sort of notion of who you really are, you know, that you got to find and stick to.
What did glam rock mean to you in its time?
In its time? Well, I guess, you know, it like I said, it was this invitation, sort of dangerous invitation into a series of transgressive positions in relationship to finding out who one is in the world, but done so in this very glossy, glittery, alluring, seductive manner, you know. So it became, I mean, I was a little bit too young for it, and particularly in America, where it really didn't have the same kind of commercial mainstream you know, impact that it did in the UK. And when I first encountered those images of, you know, Bowie's face on the cover of Aladdin Sane in the record stores or whatever, at age 10 and 11, it was sort of too much for me. It was too dangerous, too forbidden in a way, but it still made a very deep impression.
Now, why did it seem dangerous to you?
I think it was this androgyny. I think it was this glamorous beauty on the face of a man, also in the guise of some sort of a space alien. You know, in a way, all these images were sort of thrust together in this interesting distillation of, you know, the pop icon as a sort of homosexual alien, you know, offering to take you somewhere completely new. And this image of David Bowie and Angela Bowie as the sort of bisexual couple of the future brought so many things into question, you know, about sexual stability, about monogamy, what is a relationship, what is a marriage. All of these ideas are sort of, you know, challenged in one image of this sort of, it must have seemed like the sort of space age futuristic, you know, world that was about to unfurl, that this would be the way we would all behave in the future, where sexual orientation and identity would no longer be stable.
Was it scary to you because it was forcing you to confront things that you weren't ready to think about yet?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was more comfortable with Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which, you know, included a lot of the themes that were found in glam rock in artists like Bowie's work and Roxy Music and Alice Cooper and stuff, artists like that. But it was a little bit easier. It was a little bit more of a mainstreaming of those themes.
Now, it's been reported that early on in the making of your movie, The Velvet Goldmine, you colored your hair and wore platform shoes, doing a little bit of the glam thing while you were directing the movie. And then you said you gave it up because it was just too high maintenance. It is really a lot of work to have.
It's a lot of work, you know? I wasn't really doing it while we were shooting. It was really more in the writing stage.
Oh.
And I was very intrigued by this whole concept of kind of constructing oneself from the outside in, kind of changing oneself from the outside in that, you know, if you changed your hair and you started to wear different kind of clothes, some radical sort of sensibility would follow. And I saw that being played out not only in Bowie's quest to find the look that would finally work in the marketplace, but in Oscar Wilde as well, the way he constructed himself as a as Oscar Wilde, you know, one of the first celebrities of his era to do so with such sort of self-consciousness, I think. But it's funny for guys, you know, to wear super tight clothes and teetering on high heels with puffy hair that the wind sort of whistles through. You know, you feel this strange vulnerability, but also this funny kind of strength in it as well. This sort of like, you know, bitchy kind of conviction about who you are in the world that I guess women might feel when they're sort of made to feel vulnerable but attractive at the same time.
See, I think it's kind of subversive and liberating for a man perhaps to put on this mask of clothes and makeup and you know a new expressive hairdo and stuff. And I think it's often liberating for women to not do that.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
So many of us were brought up thinking that you had to do that just to survive in the world. You had to have, you know, high heels that you can't walk on and that hurt your feet and, you know, strapless gowns and just all these, you know, strange things that make it very hard to function.
Absolutely. So, but for men to feel attractive through vulnerability is such a different experience for most men. Mm-hmm, you know, that's just not what we're trained to feel ever, you know. So it was a funny, really an interesting little experiment. Didn't last too long, thankfully.
Oh, because you have a choice.
Yeah, it's true.
My guest is Todd Haynes. He wrote and directed the new film Velvet Goldmine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Todd Haynes is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Velvet Goldmine, which is about the glam rock movement of the early 70s. And he also wrote and directed Safe and Poison. Now, one of your kind of theories in The Velvet Goldmine is that The pop stars of the glam rock era are in their own ways, well, almost reincarnations of Oscar Wilde. You know, Kurt Wilde, one of the pop stars in your movie, says, "A man's life is his image," a kind of echo of the Oscar Wilde saying, which is also in your movie, "The first duty in life is to assume oppose what the second duty is. No one has yet found out." Mm. And then one of the characters says, "Give him a mask and he'll tell you the truth." Do you think that the glam rock people saw themselves as descendants of Oscar Wilde?
I'm not sure that the kids of the period and a lot of the more mainstream bands of the period were as sort of aware of a lot of the literary traditions that they were, that I see them following in, you know, in the footsteps of. But definitely Bowie, Brian Ferry, Brian Eno, this art school tradition that I was referring to earlier, were, you know, sort of inundated by literary references, cinematic references, pop cultural references, and drew from all of this stuff in the creation of these looks and styles and the music that ensued. And so when I did my research, I sort of tried to retrace those steps and go back to the sources that were inspiring these artists, and in a way try to find a cinematic, a visual equivalent or a narrative equivalent to what they were doing musically. And I couldn't not avoid Oscar Wilde. I mean, he just kept kind of coming up when you look at the ways in which they were sort of challenging natural models for the whole idea of performance, the whole idea of identity and sexuality. Oscar Wilde just became the obvious sort of precursor to that in maybe the most articulate spokesperson for this tradition in England. And it's very English. It's a really English thing that I think as an American I was doubly curious about sort of trying to understand.
Your film made me think in part about the impact that glam rock must have had on a lot of sexually repressed or sexually confused teenagers who loved rock and roll and loved the music and saw this kind of great flamboyance and this great sexual flamboyance.
Mm-hmm.
And what impact all that must have had on the more repressed and confused fans? Did you find yourself thinking about that a lot?
I did. I felt that obviously the film is almost exclusively rooted in the point of view of the fan, who's played by Christian Bale, who plays Arthur Stewart in the movie, and how his memories of this period sort of meant everything to him. The period opened up possibilities that he never again in his life felt close to, and in fact the subsequent life he led was almost a repression, necessitated by this radical moment. And I, again, it wasn't my direct experience with glam rock, but I think there were other ways, other kinds of work coming out of this period, and probably films that I was seeing more in my life that opened possibilities up to me, and that made me want to become a filmmaker. But what's really interesting about glam rock too is that it wasn't exclusive to, although it was mostly men up there on stage playing with, you know, a new kind of femininity and androgyny. Female audiences were incredibly riveted to it. And there wasn't a sort of logical identification. When David Bowie came out as bisexual, everyone was like, oh, you're going to lose your girl fans. And in fact, it only, you know, excited his audiences and they increased. And girls could enter into this sort of fantasy world of dressing up and of changing and of altering oneself just as easily as guys could. So it wasn't directly a gay interpretation or gay identification in a young boy that it was aimed at or that it worked on, which is curious to me. It's sort of how pop culture works in all these illogical ways too, which are pretty amazing.
You know, glam rock played with gender and sexual orientation, and yet I suspect that a lot of rock fans, at least ones in America, didn't really get all the sexual stuff that was maybe implied by it. Because I remember, like, when the news came out that David Bowie was bisexual and he'd slept with men, a lot of people were like, oh my God, he did? Like,
right.
Wow. And they were
right.
Stunned, like, I'm shocked. And so it seems to me, if all of this was registering about, you know, sexual identity, that people wouldn't have been quite so surprised.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Or it works at all of these sort of, you know, sort of subconscious or intuited levels, I guess, where when it's literalized, you can't really deal with it, but it can function in all these suggestive ways, these visual cues. I mean, he was so camp on stage in that period, as were many of the other artists as well, Brian Ferry as well, who you don't really think of as playing with sexual roles to anywhere near the degree of Bowie, was just mincing around on stage at the beginning as well. It was sort of like de rigueur of this period. And I think it's almost amazing how much that can be tolerated before you name it. And then when you name it, a lot of people, particularly in America, where things maybe are still in a more puritanistic, you know, literal context, or maybe more at that time, would freak out.
Now, some of the glam rock performers were bisexual, and I read a quote from you in which you said that you found bisexuality very interesting in that it's harder to define than homosexuality. It's a more slippery concept, and it implicates everyone in it. You have to look at your own sexuality in some way that might not be as comfortable as a willing acceptance of homosexuality over there.
Right.
Would you elaborate on that, why you find bisexuality more interesting in that respect?
I guess because it's not fixed. Again, I think we're most comfortable as a society with stable, concrete, you know, notions based on natural models of identity and sexuality as sort of these organic properties that you got to find and stick to. And bisexuality, which, you know, of course is part of the sort of whole Freudian, you know, thought, which defines all of us at the earliest stage as sort of polymorphously perverse, but then ultimately his theories, you know, have to take us to a place of getting normalized into a single sexual orientation. But there was something really risky and almost aggressive about bisexuality in this period. And I think it's as disquieting to gay people as it is to straight people. I think the whole liberation of the gay community has found great solace in this idea of being just as fixed and identified, you know, that you see the world completely through your sexual identity. That's who you are. You're a gay person, and there's something very stable and very comfortable about that, as comfortable and as stable as heterosexual models. But there becomes, at times, a sort of rigidity to that as well, where I have many gay friends now who have just inadvertently started relationships with women, gay men. And there's a sector of the gay community that's like, whoa, my God, that's so weird. You know, what's going on? You know, he's in denial. Or I think it's always great when sexuality surprises you and forces you to rethink the world, you know, and sort of sneaks up under our sort of safe ideas of who we are. And bisexuality is certainly that concept, I think, does that to both straights and gays.
Well, I think some people see bisexuals almost as tourists. You know, you can have a relationship with somebody of the same sex, but it doesn't mean you're like you're really gay. You're just a tourist there. It's
exactly.
Not an authentic thing.
Right. But again, it's about based on authenticity and finding stability and sync, you know, staying in one place.
And that's supposed to be. And you're not interested in that kind of authenticity.
Well, I wish I was bisexual. I'm afraid I'm not. I'm bisexual in my mind, as I know, you know, certain people have said it before, and it always kind of bugs me when they say that. But it's true. I you know, I kind of wish I could be, but I'm not.
Well, why do you think you wish you could be, and why do you think you're not?
Why do I wish I could be? Well, I have wonderful women friends who I adore, you know, and I often think they're even more, or maybe a lot more emotionally sophisticated in a lot of ways than men. And, you know, I would love to be able to engage, you know, intimately with that. But it's not where my desires take me, I guess, right now. But, you know, things change. We'll see what happens.
Todd Haynes wrote and directed the new film Velvet Goldmine. Here's a song written for the film called Ballad of Maxwell Demon. Maxwell Demon is the alter ego of the film's central character, Brian Slade.
Got tired of wasting gas, living above the planet. Boys of Quad 44, vicious metal hounds never come around here no more. Sometimes I wonder if I'm still alive. Six feet down at age 25. Maxwell Bell, a demon, rock and jive.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Sheryl Crow's latest CD, This is Fresh Air.